Anyway, as I was saying about Twain, he smoked. The one thing he was really addicted to, isn't this great? I can keep.
That's right.
The one thing is just talk about a monologist.
You don't need me.
I don't know. What are you doing here? This is like class. You know, my students leave. I'm still lecturing.
Yeah, when crazy humor writers Dan Greenberg and Susanna O'Malley came in, they'd written an absolutely silly little book that I probably shouldn't have reviewed on the air, but I had done Dan Greenberg a year previously, and he's so funny that when they came in, I just put him down in front of two microphones and said, go ahead, I'm leaving. Do whatever you want to do. And they were happy. They did. They had worked up. They had gone all over the country to promote their book. And Freundlich Publishers, whoever they are here.
Freundlich. Friendly.
And
friendship. Yeah. Friendly, I guess, yeah.
So they had worked out a little routine. They sang a little. They did little skits, and they sang something. Great for television. But it turned out to be a nice radio thing, too, because I was really not involved in it.
This is the variation on the old lock two people in a room and see who wins routine.
Well, let's talk about you before our time runs out, Jack Matthews. Give me a little bit, work up to things. I have a number of questions I want to ask you. Give me a little of your background, both as a teacher and a writer, and how did it all begin and where?
I was born and reared in Columbus, Ohio, but it was virtually woodland and fields when I was a boy. This was in Clintonville in North Columbus, where I grew up there and went to North High School, went to Ohio State.
Ohio State.
I'm sorry about it. There's nothing we can do this late, but I've been trying to amend for that in the past 20 years by teaching at Ohio University. Went into the Coast Guard in World War II and then came out and decided that I would like to write philosophical novels. I was interested in philosophy. In fact, my veterans advisor, when I said I was interested in philosophy, looked for a philosopher under P, and he didn't find this as an employable category. So I decided to major in classical Greek and English literature, which I did, and then was astounded to find upon graduation that I was not employable. I thought perhaps somebody would hire me to sit around and think great thoughts, or maybe even pretty good thoughts. But
that major hasn't changed in terms of employability either.
I'm afraid not. I'm still waiting to be employed justly. Then I got my master's. I went to work in the post office, had a variety of jobs, part-time, some of them, and had a growing family by this time, so I had to have some sort of stability. And I worked in the post office for 9 years, and then started teaching at Urbana College in Urbana, Ohio, and taught there for 5 years. And my first book was published with Scribner's, a book of short stories titled Bitter Knowledge. And then I went to Ohio University in 1964, and I've been there ever since.
What year was that first book?
1964, the very year it came out, was the year I went to Ohio U.
Uh-huh. Had these stories been collected in magazines?
Yes. All of them had been previously published. Scribner's had a special line then of first publications, a first edition series or something. I forget exactly what it was called. But it was a kind of idealistic venture. I think probably they could afford to do it because they still held copyright on Thomas Wolfe and Hemingway and, I believe, Fitzgerald.
Your first book must be a great rarity in value today.
Well, it certainly was a small printing, but occasionally...
How large a printing was it?
I think it was 2,000. Mm-hmm. But it came, and there may have been 1,000 or 2,000 paperback, too. It came out simultaneously hardbound and paperback. But I was certainly pleased to come out with Scribner's. It was not the kind of thing that would be promoted ardently by any sensible publisher, but it was, from my standpoint, it was a handsome thing to happen. And the critical response, such as it was quite good.
Tell me about your first novel.
My first novel was Hanger Stout Awake, and that's hanger as in clothes hanger, but it has to do with a young man who finds that he has a very high threshold of pain, and he can hang longer from a bar than anybody else. He's a natural athlete at this. And I used to enjoy saying that I was hoping this would become a sport recognized by the NCAA and that there would be hanging contests with marching bands, cheerleaders. But I understand that hasn't happened. It's a whimsical idea, certainly, but Hanger is a comic novel, too, as you might surmise. But Hanger is also something of a saint, if that is to say, his high threshold of pain is something of a metaphor for his ability to withstand the scorn and the ridicule of other people. He's a pathologically poor speller and has just graduated from high school, just being moved through. He's not been a success in anything. He works in a filling station. In fact, in the Book of the Month Club review, it was mentioned that the reviewer, several years later, referred to Hangar's Thought Awake as the first of a series of novels about automobiles, the automobile culture. And whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I was pleased with it. And it also had a modest success. I think there were five printings altogether, but they were all small, but this suggested a more or less sustained interest.
How did it happen that you became an ardent book collector as well?
I bought my first rare book in 1943 in an attic on Oakland Park Avenue in Columbus. I was just out of high school then, and I remember seeing a book published in Dayton in 1840. It was about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and I thought, what a marvelous thing to have, a book that was that old, over 100 years old at that time, about this legendary journey across the continent. And I felt a thrill, and I paid a dime for it. And it's not an excessively rare book, but it's still a nice book to have, and I still have it. The other book that I bought for a dime was a Renunciation of Universalism. Universalism was the theory that that everybody would be saved, and evidently it was controversial because there were a lot of people who didn't think heaven would be heaven if everybody was saved. And anyway, that's an eminently forgettable book, and why I should remember it, I don't know.
You still have it?
No, that one I've
Well, apparently you started very early in seeking out Americana, then, huh?
Yeah, that's a little misleading because for a long period after that, I had the prejudice against collecting that it was a rich man's hobby or a rich man's enterprise. And this simply isn't true, and eventually I found out better that if you're willing to spend a little time and to learn, if you're interested in books, you learn naturally. You read about the sorts of rarities, and then you become something of a scout. You learn that certain books are negotiable, and they may not be in your particular collecting interest, but you know that you can trade with dealers for books that you do want for your personal collection. And of course, building a personal collection is an existential act, and it's an act of great majesty and great importance. It's creating your own personal environment. You know, this is what you are. This reflects what you want to stay with you.
How did you happen, even though you are a collector, and not every collector is an authority, but you obviously became an authority because of your book, Collecting Rare Books for Pleasure and Profit. So how did you become so knowledgeable in this field?
Well, thank you for the premise of that. It's a natural result, I think, of a passionate interest in simply pursuing it and having time. It's nice to be able to teach. I think probably I put as much time in teaching as certainly I put a 40-hour week in, but 40 hours a week I work at least. But those 40 hours I can put into different slots. I have time off that I can attend an auction in a way that somebody who is locked into an office for 8 hours a day cannot. So it was a natural outgrowth of my interest in books and my widening interest, because I first collected modern first editions and then went on to Americana, which is more and more an interest with me. The great thing about book collecting is that you simply can't know enough about it, and this is the adventure. You're constantly coming across editions you don't know about and entire books that you know absolutely nothing about. And I think you should trust your impulse, because often these things, since if you don't know about them, there's a good likelihood that nobody else does either. And it's interesting to pick up a book that's 150 years old and read it and receive a message that was sent 150 years ago that nobody else is taking in. This is experiencing some aspect of life that would otherwise be lost. This is a romantic idea, I know, but it's there.
Before we get to Sassafras, a couple more questions along this line. Do you impart your enthusiasm for collecting books to your students?
I love to bring it up in class, and I try to at least once a quarter. And I think it is almost inevitably success. That is to say, students are fascinated by the idea of collecting books. First of all, I'm working with something of a select audience. If they're taking a literature course or a writing course, we can assume that they should have a little more interest in books than the general population. But I think that students are more interested now, for instance, than they would have been 20 years ago. This is certainly something that I can't document or prove, but I find that they're interested in the investment aspect, which certainly should be secondary. But I think they like the idea of having rare books, of having a first edition of an author whose work they genuinely admire. And they like the idea of being able to buy a contemporary author, for instance, a poet, and buy his works at trade prices and build a library, draw a line around this particular work, or collect according to a theme. Everybody has an interest, and mm-hmm. whatever your interest is, it's reflected in the world of books.
Well, when I was in college in the 1950s, so I bought paperbacks. They were a quarter then, and none of us had very much money, and buying a hardcover book was a major investment for me in the 1950s, but at Christmas time, my mother and father would give me usually a book or two, and that was very exciting. I always kept my books with me. But looking back, if I had been more attuned to book collecting and what it means and the value of these books, think of all of the major books that came out in the 1950s, things like the Salingers and James Jones and all of these books that sold for $2, $3. It seems cheap now. Maybe it wasn't as cheap then. But if students, young people, were to have an appreciation for books and were to start collecting important authors now, everybody gets older, and these kids are going to get older. You know, they may be 20 years old now, but they're going to be 40 years old, and if they started collecting at 20, they're going to have a nice collection. But isn't the problem for most people knowing what to collect and what authors to have?
I think so, and I think that the challenge here is, and this is deceptively easy, but because it's hard to be honest, but you should collect what you honestly respect. I think that if you can pick up books that you know are admired generally, and if you can get them cheaply, there's nothing wrong with that, and then you can trade them. But this isn't collecting itself. This is being a dealer or a book scout, in effect, even if you do it on a fairly modest scale. And you're absolutely right about the availability of books. Books are remaindered now. Hardbound books are remaindered, and they're often cheaper than new paperbacks. And I've seen at various sales, I've seen paperbacks sell for more money than hardbound books because, quote, they're cheaper, unquote.
In the same store.
In the same store.
You can often go to a bookstore, and in the remaindered portion and down in the basement is the hardcover of the more expensive paperback upstairs.
I have a theory about that. I think that buying a hardbound book is a commitment independently of money. There's a little taboo in destroying a book or throwing it away. We are all, in one respect or another, people of the book. This is the source of our learning and of our national memory, of our cultural memories. And I think that a paperback somehow doesn't bother us. It announces its ephemeral quality to us. It is an item of ephemera. And, of course, ironically, the more ephemeral aspects of rare books are often the most admired. For instance, I heard that recently a Fitzgerald first edition with dust jacket sold for $800, and without dust jacket it sold for $75. Well, that's ridiculous. Except that for every copy in a good dust jacket you find, you'll find 15 or 20 without dust jacket. So it's a matter of supply and demand. Somebody who wants a pristine copy or a mint or even a very good or fine copy will often pay an enormous premium. And that does verge upon the ridiculous.
But. Where do you put your book collection?
Well, I have my books in just about every room in the house. And then we bought an old saloon, defunct saloon, I should say, in a nearby coal mining town, Gloucester, Ohio. Bought it to store books in, and I thought I would sell to dealers. My wife suggested that if we were going to sell to dealers, we might open to the public. So we were open every Saturday, and it was great fun. It was nice seeing students come out and buy books and seeing them start libraries and get interested in the idea of rarity in books and to cherish books for reasons other than the immediate reading experience, which of course is, after all, at the heart of books. But it was not. It's not feasible to continue this, so we're kind of back to square one, and we're using the building for storage once more.
Sassafras, in just a moment, but another question or two about your teaching students. You teach both creative writing and English, is that correct?
Correct, yes.
What authors are being taught? What authors are being read in college now? I'm talking about the modern writers.
Right. That's almost impossible to answer. Because a lot of courses are genre courses, I don't know what people who are teaching science fiction, for instance, which is now respectable, academically respectable, I don't know what authors are being taught in such courses. I often work with my creative writing students with the standard anthologies, the best American short stories of the year and the O. Henry Prize stories. And it's easier to work with short stories, of course, because you can get over your mistakes more quickly. Short stories aren't intrinsically easier to write. In fact, some people argue fairly cogently that the demand is even greater to write a really effective short story. But certainly, for pedagogical purposes, you can work with short stories more conveniently than you can with novels.
What are young people in college writing about?
Well, because 1 year merges imperceptibly into the next, I can't really clearly tell you what changes I've noticed over the past 25 years that I've been teaching. I have noticed certain features of the writing, however, that interest me, and I think of them as, and this is going to sound more pejorative than I intend it to sound, but I think of them, students today, as the Mad Magazine generation. There's a cartoon effectiveness, or a cartoon effect, rather, in their writing. Radical juxtaposition, the rapid shooting of image after image without necessary continuity, without building. These are features of a lot of student stories that I read, and they can generate considerable power, but you pay a price for everything, and some of the things, one of the prices you pay for such an effect, a cartoon effect or a Mad Magazine effect, is that of subtlety, of nuance, and of depth and character. It seems to me that fiction is ideally suited for celebrating the miraculous power of cause and effect, which is intrinsic to our idea of character. And this may sound very grandiose and very noble, but I think this is a venerable and ancient ideal that fiction, ancient in, with reference to the history of the novel, for instance, that fiction has perpetuated and has developed. D.H. Lawrence said that the novel is the best model we have of the complexity of human interrelatedness. And I think that this is unquestionably true. There is a civilizing effect to reading fiction in understanding point of view, for instance. In featuring, for instance, a protagonist who is intent upon one end, and you feel that you've solved the humanity of the situation he finds himself in, and then suddenly being shown another perspective into the same event, being forced to understand that there's another way of looking at the same set of values. This civilizes people.
Are you spotting any pockets of creative talents in your classes? Because I remember my literary transgressions against Hollis Summers back when I was in the 50s, and some of the things I wrote, which were the epitome of mundane student interest, embarrass me to think about today.
Sometimes, it's hard to predict, of course. Sometimes, one of the remarks one of my professors made about my writing was, that I cherish, was that in my own way I was probably the worst writer in the class, and of course it's hard to insult somebody who has the ego to be a writer, and I simply drew a line around the phrase "in my own way" and cherished that if I was going to be bad, at least I was being uniquely bad. It is hard to determine or to judge who might or might not be successful. Certainly, there are very few students who have the neuromuscularity, to use an utterly impossible metaphor, who have the strength of nerve to become a writer. It's a cruel undertaking. The assaults upon the ego are notorious, and that's why I think a lot of writers who become celebrities, and celebrities generally, tend to be fear biters. But occasionally you'll find a student who has a natural gift for narrative fluency. And I recall one of my students several years ago who did an honors project with me. Her name is Karen Carey, and she we were talking about the story of Odysseus, and she wondered what happened to Odysseus after the end of the Odyssey, and I said, well, why don't you write a novel about it? And she did, and it's called The Last Voyage of Odysseus, and it was published by the Ohio University Press, which was a little self-serving of me. I'm on the board of the press, but I thought it would help her, and I thought it would help the press, too, because it's a very entertaining and a very interesting novel. It's not a profound or a great or a richly realized novel, but this is a very young woman we're talking about, and I think when you have somebody who has a natural narrative gift, why, you cherish that and you appreciate it.
Well, let's talk for a minute or two about Sassafras, because we're almost out of time, but obviously one of the primary reasons that you're here is to talk about your novel. This will take a little discipline on your part, but if it's possible, because of time constraints, to give my listeners perhaps a 30-second capsule of what the novel is about.
It's about a young man born in Ohio in 1825 who grows up to become a phrenologist. This is a person who felt that you can determine human character by the shape of the head, bumps on the head. And he becomes a professional phrenologist and gets a Conestoga wagon with a human skull painted on the side and goes out west into the Kansas Territory, where he meets an incredible an assembly of banditos and human curiosities, as you can imagine. One is a circus giant, an ex-circus giant. Another man is harlequin-faced. He befriends a young Indian who is walking backwards toward the river to drown himself. And when asked why he's walking backwards to drown himself and commit suicide, he says because he wants to look back upon his life immediately before dying. And my protagonist saves this Indian, whose name is Henry Buck, and they become companions on the Conestoga wagon, bopping about the Old West.
To what extent did you draw upon your collection of Americana for your research?
Very greatly. I love to read Americana, and again, I think stories are things that happen to people who have somehow become writers, so that I'm always, in a sense, taking notes, as I assume other writers do. And even when I'm reading something that has no, that I'm not thinking of at all in terms of story material, nevertheless, I'm in the posture of being interested. And of course, the first person to be interested in writing is the writer himself or herself.
Sassafras is quite a departure from the used car salesman in the charisma campaigns. Were you ever a used car salesman?
No, I wasn't. I've never been a used car salesman, but I'm engaged in teaching, and which is manipulating other people, and there's always an element of trickery in manipulating other people. I think it can be benign, but an assignment is a trick that is tacitly agreed upon, that you play upon various people. You know, write a short story for next week. Mm-hmm. You're insisting upon people doing things that are a little unnatural. And in a sense, Thaddeus Burke, the hero of Sassafras, is not a con man, as he was called in one of the reviews. I don't think of him that way, but he is certainly concerned about convincing other people of the validity of phrenology. Phrenology was an empirical science, and it was not a science at all, really. It turned out that it was a kind of a kooky fad, but people were enormously interested in it. And I think that people are no more sophisticated today. I think if a few gifted phrenologists went out, that they could probably make a good living.
Could get them tarred and feathered, too.
Yes.
Why is it that your protagonist in the charisma campaigns wears a string tie?
Well, he has two salesmen, and he wears a string tie, which actually isn't a bullet tie. People think of a bullet tie as a string tie, but there's a distinction. The string tie is actually the cloth that was, as a matter of fact, featured on the dust jacket of Sassafras. But one of his salesmen, Cripps, wears a bow tie, and the other one, Bucky Buckholz, wears a regular cloth tie. So each of the three salesmen has a different tie, and these are little signs of the enormous difference in personality among them.
Jack Matthews, I could go on and talk to you forever, but with a little show like mine, it means many, many minutes of waiting through tape to cut. So I'll clip it here, but I want to thank you very much. You were relaxed and calm, and Walter Tevis was in 2 weeks ago, extremely nervous, and I think I told you on the phone was chain smoking, but you're just nice and calm, and nothing phases you.
Well, it helps not to be too conscious. That's just...